Now Monitor brings you Meet the Press, the prize-winning interview program produced by Lawrence E. Spivak. Four of America's top news reporters are ready for this unrehearsed conference. Here's the moderator of Meet the Press, Ned Brooks.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. Our guest today is Mr. Thomas E. Dewey, the former governor of New York. Over a period of 20 years, he has been one of the most influential leaders of the Republican Party. His long service has earned for him the role of elder statesman, although he is only 58 years old. He served as governor for 12 years. In 1944 and again in 1948, Governor Dewey received the party's highest honor, the nomination for president. In the campaign of 1952, as the titular head of his party, Governor Dewey played a leading role in winning the presidential nomination for General Eisenhower. Over a long period, Governor Dewey has been a student of foreign affairs. After retiring as governor, he made a tour around the world, visiting the leading countries of Europe and Asia. Since then, he has revisited Europe, and he has visited South America several times. He is now engaged in the private practice of law. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Governor Dewey, are Chet Huntley of NBC News, Robert White of the New York Herald Tribune, John Oakes of the New York Times, and Lawrence E. Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. Now, Governor, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Spivak.
Governor, you were among the first to recognize that we're in a fight for survival with the communists. You think as a nation we've acted as though we were?
Well, that's a pretty hard question to answer. Of course, yes and no. But I think that at least since the Korean War came on, there's been a recognition of it in the national administration. And I believe that our defenses and our diplomatic policy has recognized that there is a great power in the world which is determined to obliterate human freedom and subject it to a single world dictatorship run from Moscow.
Governor, maybe I ought to explain a bit more clearly what I meant. One of the serious charges that is being made against this administration is that it is promoting private prosperity at the expense of national power. And that as a result, the influence of the United States as a world power is declining. We're building plenty of cars, and we're building plenty of refrigerators, but we're falling behind on education, on ICBMs, on space, engineers, and things of that kind. Now, would you say that as a nation, we did recognize, as you recognize, the fight we're in?
Well, that's another global question. To be entirely specific, for example, I have read the views of those who believe that too much of the total gross national product of the United States is being spent by individuals as they wish to spend it, and too little is being spent by government. I disagree with that point of view. Dr. Saulnier, the president's economic advisor, made a, I thought, an excellent exposition of his point of view on it the other day. And certainly, if you're referring to the two schools of thought, it seems to me that there's very little ground to support those who believe that it's government's function to take away from people all the money it can get and spend all of the money that the people should be spending themselves. I think that it's far better to let people spend the money as they wish. Now, if there were a serious better let the people spend their own money as they wish. And moreover, I'm quite confident that if we should deprive the people of this country of the incentive which makes a free enterprise system work any further than we have, that our gross national product would decline rapidly and disastrously. So that I believe that we are spending as much as we need in government areas, both state and national. I think we're spending more than we need in many municipalities and many states, and more than we need in some areas of the national. I am not sufficient of an expert to say whether we're spending enough, too much, or too little on military defenses and research.
Well, Governor, if we are to meet Soviet challenge in education and economic growth and military strength, you think we can do it in any other way except through federal action, federal expenditures? Can you do it through private?
Your question implies this ghastly identity between spending money and getting something.
Well, I'm only going to Republicans for that. The Rockefeller Report. When Governor Rockefeller was head of the Rockefeller Report at the time, he brought out the fact that we weren't spending enough for defense. We weren't spending enough for education.
I still don't have to say that I think spending money gets you anything. That's one of the illusions of our time. It's a question of the brains you apply in spending it and how it's spent. And I'm perfectly clear in my mind that you're not going to get any better education by spending more money on it. You're going to get better education by having higher standards and getting the young people to work. I think that if you want to get right down to the ugly realities, the average student in a what is comparable to our high school in Russia works twice as many hours as ours do. And if they don't get to stay in school, they go out to work. And only those who show real talent are allowed in the universities. And there they work. Those are not playgrounds. And incidentally, this also is true in Britain, where they get a vastly greater result for very much less money.
Mr. Oakes.
Governor, on this global question for just a moment longer, you stated in October of 56, during the course of a national campaign, that Mr. Stevenson's proposal to end H-bomb testing, or that the United States should take the lead in ending H-bomb testing, was an invitation to national suicide. Would you care to tell us whether your views on this problem have changed at all over the years, and how you view the American position in the negotiations on this subject now?
Well, we certainly haven't come to any smaller questions. No, my view is the same. As a matter of fact, that was an act of folly to propose, because Mr. Stevenson proposed, in effect, a unilateral discontinuance. We'll quit experimenting, you go right ahead, and we will trust to your charity and your good faith. Well, anybody who ever trusted to the charity and good faith of a communist ended up dead. And I don't propose that our country or the free world should end up obliterated by Soviet developments in the nuclear field made while we were generously saying we will not experiment because we hope you won't.
No, I don't think anyone would, sir.
Well, that's exactly what Mr. Stevenson proposed in 1956, and it was, in my judgment, it would have been a catastrophe had he been elected and been able to carry it out.
Would you feel...
And nobody, as far as I know, in the Senate or the United States or the House today, adheres to that position.
Would you tell me how you feel about the present negotiations in Geneva on this question, which we are invited to accept a moratorium?
Well, once again, we get down to the... We get into the global area. If we abandon nuclear weapons, if the time comes when there aren't any, then I should like to see the United States and the free world have some opportunity to defend itself with other weapons. We are faced by an aggressive state which has determined and publicly said it's part of its creed that it's going to conquer the world by one means or another, and they're busy trying it. If the Russians, with they had 200 divisions and another 100 in Central Europe, it's hard to talk about divisions now since we deal in terms of missiles and aircraft more, but they have a heavy preponderance of manpower dedicated to war. If you add to their population that of China, you have 200 million Russians, 100 million in Central Europe, and the latest figures that I've heard accepted horrify me, there's about 800 million Chinese now who are aggressive, brutal, and don't observe any rules of civilized mankind. So that makes 1,100,000 people, which is more than twice as many as there are in North America and Europe combined. I would like something better than guns or men to have a civilized community such as ours defend itself against a barbaric community where human life means nothing and they can produce armies that outnumber ours at 2 and 3 to 1.
So you're suggesting then that the present negotiations aren't anything, will not lead to anything at all?
I'm suggesting that I would be fearful if they led to a discontinuance of nuclear weapons until there was genuine, guaranteed, ironclad, complete inspection to make sure they kept their word. And secondly, a stage-by-stage discontinuance of all other weapons of aggression so that we could not only have total disarmament, but enforceable total disarmament. So we wouldn't be the good, honest folks who didn't have a bow and arrow left while the other side had all there was.
Mr. White.
Governor Dewey, swinging over to the 1960 campaign, we keep hearing that Adlai Stevenson's 2 defeats will hurt his chances if he runs again. You've had some experience in this area of voter behavior. How does a loss in one election year affect the strength of a candidate in another?
I don't know. I don't believe I got any... I don't think there was a substantial difference in total votes between my 44 and 48 campaigns. Or in the percentage of the votes, maybe a little. Yes, there was a higher percentage in the second campaign than in the first. I think Mr. Stevenson had more votes but a lower percentage in his second campaign. I would say this, that of all the educational experiences of which I have any acquaintance, running for president is the hardest work and the most illuminating on many subjects. So if a man has run once, he knows more, but whether he'd be a better or worse candidate, I don't know. I don't propose ever to find out myself anymore, but maybe the Democrats would like to conduct that experiment. I would leave that to them.
Governor, what in your judgment will be the issue or issues in the coming campaign, the coming election?
Well, it seems to me that if a party has been in charge of a nation for 8 years and has managed in the face of dreadful provocation to keep the peace by great strength, not by responding to war, but by being strong enough to prevent war, as we did by our position in Taiwan, as we did in our position in Lebanon, which everybody's forgotten about. We landed troops in Lebanon. First time any American troops have been landed on the continent of Europe since they were there in World War II. When a party has been that successful in keeping the peace, it's entitled to great confidence from the people. And when it also has been successful in maintaining the highest percentage of employment ever maintained in peace times over such a period in our history, then I should think that those would be the issues. I assume the opposition will find some things they don't like or they want to talk about.
Mr. Huntley.
Governor Dewey, from what you have said in response to several of the preceding questions, I take it that you believe we're engaged in a grim struggle with a tough and rather formidable adversary. I would like to ask you, do you think the American people are sufficiently aware of this?
I think that pretty nearly everybody in the United States, I'd say 90-odd percent, which is unanimous, is thoroughly aware of it. But when a thing is 5, 10, or 20,000 miles away, and when you don't see imminent danger, and when you have your own problems after getting up in the morning all day long and going to bed, and then you got a new set of problems tomorrow, you don't tend to think about it first. You tend to think that that's the government's job. I think that if there were any necessity for major action of a sacrificial character, and the president called on the people, I think they'd respond. I don't think anybody would like it, but I think there's a pretty general awareness of the nature of the of what's going on in the world.
Well, are you satisfied, Governor, with the way the present administration has kept the people informed about the severity of this struggle?
I don't know what a government can do to keep people fully informed beyond hoping that they'll read what's going on all over, including the latest in Cuba, 90 miles off our shores, what goes on in Latin American countries. I noticed that the faculties of several of the colleges in the university at Caracas voted communist control yesterday, according to the morning paper, which I think is pretty serious, and I think that people are aware of this. I think a great many people would be delighted if there was more they could do. I don't know how an administration can do more than deal specifically with issues, present them carefully in state papers, select the ablest and the best people to represent us and to run the government and to go to these dreadfully important conferences that are now going on in Geneva. Beyond that, I wouldn't know what to do, but I'm not much a very good publicist. Maybe you could tell us better.
Mr. Spivak.
Governor, how do you explain the fact that so little of President Eisenhower's popularity has rubbed off on the Republican Party itself?
That's the mystery of the age. I just don't know.
The latest Gallup poll shows that only 30% of those polled consider themselves Republicans and 47% Democrats and 23% Independents.
I just don't know. I guess that goes back to just the last question I answered. You have to be a better publicist. The Republicans tend to do the work, and the Democrats tend to do the talking.
That's been the historic
definition, in my opinion. Some people might disagree.
You think the job the Republicans are doing are all right, it's just that they haven't publicized it effectively?
Yeah,
people?
I really do.
May I
speak? I think it's an extraordinary record. I don't believe anybody has ever, any party has ever had eight such difficult and challenging and successful years. But I think the people sort of tend to give the president the credit for the success and blame the party on the things they don't like.
Do you think this could overcome the low status of the Republican Party, a ticket of Nixon and Rockefeller? Do you think that would be the strongest Republican ticket?
Well, I'm not going to pick tickets here.
I think it would be
a tremendous ticket, of course.
Do you see any possibility that that could be the ticket?
Governor Rockefeller has said that he will not accept a vice presidential nomination.
Yes, but you know the pressures better than almost anybody of the Republican conventions.
Yes, but I don't know how things will look next July and how he'll feel about it. And I certainly wouldn't be in a position to speak for him.
Mr. Oakes.
Governor Rockefeller has described you, and I'm quoting, as a great statesman and a great political leader. How would you describe Governor Rockefeller?
I certainly would have to return the compliment in the same words and mean it.
Do you feel that his withdrawal from the presidential race was helpful or harmful to the Republican Party?
Well, I suppose some primary fights might sometime be helpful. And on the other hand, sometimes they're divisive.
How about this one?
You can't tell until it has happened, and then you look back and view the wreckage and see whether it was good or bad. Well, I don't know how it would have worked out.
Well, may I ask if you were in favor of his withdrawing, or did you have a feeling of pleasure or sorrow after his withdrawal?
Well, I had a little of both, to tell you the truth. Strictly accurate statement.
May I ask you who your candidate for the presidency is, whom you are supporting?
There's only one.
There's no
Mr.
question.
Nixon.
You unreservedly are backing him.
Certainly.
Of course.
Surely.
Well, isn't it odd that none of the other major Republican figures in this state seem to have done the same? Of the top ranking.
You know, I may not believe this, but I have not discussed the subject with them. I just haven't.
With any of the other Republican
any of the other political leaders. In the state.
You said that you
I've been busy.
You indicated a few moments ago that you wouldn't consider running for any office again. Would you consider going back into the government again?
I doubt it. No desire. I've successfully resisted that for quite a while now, and
I'm
hope
sure
to continue
to. Do you expect to continue to?
I expect to, yes.
Mr. White.
Governor, I'm sure you have a better definition yet than of the difference between the two parties than the Republicans do and the Democrats talk. This is kind of a basic question, but in this connection, in a sense, you're the elder statesman of modern republicanism. What is the difference, the basic difference, between modern Republicans and the Democrat today?
Well, I think by and large that the Republican Party produces people who do a better job in office. I think also that those very same people, because they do a better job, are staying at their office and not going around the country publicizing it. I think, moreover, that the party does not take positions that it doesn't expect to deliver on. For instance, I don't believe you'll find any speeches by President Eisenhower in the beating people over the head on the subject of civil rights. But I think also there has been more progress in his 7 years than in any comparable 7 years since the Civil War or in any comparable 40 years. I think the record will clearly sustain it.
Mr. Hutley.
In other words, I think the Republican Party delivers and the Democrats talk. That's my definition.
Mr. Hutley.
Governor, you gained national prominence through your campaign against organized crime and racketeering. From the advantage of this many years of hindsight, how successful do you think you were in breaking up the rackets in New York?
Well, so far as I know, the most lucrative single source of revenue at the time I became racket prosecutor, which is 25 years ago, was labor union racketeering. And the Dutch Schultz mob and Lepke and Gura and others, including one who was just going on trial again for the same business, controlled a pretty large share of many labor unions in the community. And we broke up all of them that I know of. Every one of them, as far as I know, got killed or was sent to prison, and the people who took his place when he got killed were sent to prison for good long terms. Now, when you deal in terms with long-range, sumptuary legislation, dealing with people's habits, the sources of revenue that tend to flow to the underworld in gambling, and other moral offenses and in narcotics, Those things flow on. They get suppressed and then they come back up again, and that's a continuing job. But the structure of organized crime, I think, was pretty well broken up. And I think Frank Hogan has done a glorious job of keeping it down.
But every once in a while, a public official today indicates that crime and corruption are things we're going to have to put up with and just abide, and they can't very well be eliminated or suppressed.
I just couldn't disagree with that more, with anything any more than I do that. It's just preposterous. They were saying in 1935 that the law was no longer able to cope with organized crime because of its many layers and the remoteness of the bosses. Well, we proved that wasn't true. It was an awful lot of hard work and took a lot of risks, and a few people got killed in the process. But we reestablished it, and I think it is established today. And the idea that the law in this country is not stronger than crime is an excuse for incompetence.
Are New York judges sufficiently tough in this area to suit you?
I would say that a good many of them were not.
Thank you.
I think at that point we'll have to bring these proceedings to a close. I'm sorry to have to interrupt, but I see that our time is up.
And Monitor's thanks to former New York Governor Thomas E. Dewey and to members of the panel for a stimulating and interesting half hour. The panelists were John B. Oakes of the New York Times, Chet Huntley of NBC News, Robert M. White II, president and editor of the New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence Spivak, the producer of Meet the Press. As usual, a personal word at this point, if I may. The 1960 census is coming in April, just a few days away. This year, a population estimated at some 180 million people will be counted. In order to speed up and simplify this enormous task, a questionnaire will be mailed to your home before April 1st. When it arrives, if it hasn't already, fill it out at your convenience, answering simple questions about the persons in your household and the house itself. The information, incidentally, that you're required to furnish is held strictly confidential by law, cannot be used for purposes of taxation, investigation, or regulation. Please have your completed questionnaire ready when the official census taker calls at your door. Census figures are very important. They determine your representation in Congress. They also point up needs for new schools, for new roads, for new housing in your community, in fact, across the nation. Remember, the 1960 census is coming in April. Be sure you're counted with all Americans. That's our story of the census, the big count, and someone's been counting the minutes and the seconds here, too. It's time for me to take my leave. News follows in a moment, but it will make no headlines, I suppose, to announce the news that parts of the preceding program were transcribed. Shall we meet again next week? Good, good. Till then, this is Ben Grauer, and may the days between be pleasant ones at your house and mine.
This is Monitor, NBC's weekend radio service.